Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer, engineer, bassist, and pro audio exec, Dusty Wakeman, who's going to talk about country music in Los Angeles, among many other things. But first, let's talk about branding. A few months ago, I was asked to be on CNN to talk about Justin Bieber breaking his brand. And that's all well and good to talk about it, but most musicians, engineers, producers, just people in the music business in general have no idea what a brand is, and especially what their brand is. And it can take quite a while to actually explain this and to go through how to find your brand, how to discover it. But let me just, in a few minutes here, give you the very short story on the whole thing. So what is a brand? A brand is a promise of quality and consistency. Anywhere you go in the world, you recognize McDonald's by the golden arches. And a Big Mac tastes like a Big Mac, tastes like a Big Mac. It doesn't matter where you're at. You could be in Moscow, you could be in Taiwan, you could be in Memphis, you could be in Los Angeles, you could be in Mexico City, a Big Mac is a Big Mac is a Big Mac. You know what the quality is going to be, for better or for worse, and you also recognize the symbol of the brand, which is the Golden Arches. And you can say the same thing for Coke or Nike or, you know, any other major brand. There's always this promise of quality and consistency. And that's something that, as a musician, a band, or an artist, it's something that we have to provide as well. Now, what that means for an artist or a band, or a musician or a producer or an engineer, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing in a way, except you're talking more about your image and more about the quality, the sound of your music. So, for instance, if you look at the Beatles, this is always a classic example. The Beatles changed with every album. Their look changed, and also their sound changed, but it never changed so much that you confused them with anybody else. You always knew it was the Beatles. And even though their look changed, again, you looked at them and they were always the Beatles. Same thing with Madonna. Madonna's done that over the years. So for a musician, it's that promise of a consistent image and a consistent quality and a consistent sound. So how do you find your brand? This is the hardest thing for just about everybody, because sometimes you find it by osmosis. It kind of finds you, and other times you do have to develop it. So the first thing in finding your brand is the name that you use. Now, for instance, if you're a producer or an engineer or musician, it doesn't matter. What name are you using? So for instance, Sting, he could have used Gordon Sumner, his real name, but Sting is certainly a lot better in that it's a cool nickname and it also instantly defines who he is. It's an instant branding. So that kind of works. So if you have a nickname, that's always a good thing to use. If you don't, just figure out the name that you're going to use. So an example, good example is me, it's Bobby Osinski. For years, I called myself Bob Osinski and I couldn't figure out why I was uncomfortable with that. Until I started to listen to people around me, and they all called me Bobby. And then I realized, well, that's really who I am. And when I changed my name to Bobby, or at least telling people what to call me, putting it on paper and signatures and everything, I felt a lot more comfortable. And that defined my image. That defined my brand in a way. And it'd be the same thing for you. If your name is Steve and you prefer to be called Steven, well, now is the time to change that and make it really consistent. So that's the first thing. Find out the name you want to use and use it. It's really easy. Next thing is, what makes you stand out? What makes you different from everybody else? And one way you find that out is just ask people that you work with. Ask other musicians. Ask other engineers. Ask clients. Ask them, what makes you stand out? Why do people like working with you? Because really, that is part of your brand. Whatever it is that makes you successful enough that people want to work with you, even if you're just starting, there are people that want to work with you. Why do they want to work with you? That's part of your brand, and that's what you should find out. You can't figure that out yourself for the most part. You have to ask other people about it. Next thing is, who do you serve? Who's your clientele? Who would you like to be your clientele? A lot of times we like to talk to somebody. A lot of times we would like to actually serve a particular client or a particular genre. but we're not. We're in another one. Well, you have to determine whether the genre you're in is important enough for you to go there and stay there, or where you'd rather go is your particular focus. So that's one of the things that you have to figure out. Who do you want to serve? Next thing is, what's your image? And this is another thing that you have to ask people about. How do they perceive you? Do you always look good in black, for instance? I've noticed that there's a trend with Detroit musicians that they always all dressed in black and they have dyed black hair. And usually you can spot a Detroit musician by that. I don't know why that is, but that's one of the things. That's one of the image things that they have. So maybe that's you. Or maybe it's just the opposite. Maybe you always dress in white. Maybe you just prefer to dress one way or the other. You prefer to dress a certain way. Well, that's part of your image. And if you can identify that, then you should dress that way more. For me, for instance, I dress in blue a lot because I always get compliments. People always say, you look really good in that shirt or whatever. So I try to dress in blue. And as a result, I've carried that over to my website. I've carried that over to social media, to logos, everything, because I've found that that just seems to be a color that works for me. So that's one of the things that you should do right off. If you want to figure out how to define your brand right off, there's really three things that you can do that are very easy. The first thing is figure out what the name you're going to be called is going to be. So for instance, just figure out what's the most comfortable for you. Go with that name, stay with that name. That's the first thing. The second thing is pick a color and stay with that color. That color should be the same for everything you do, either offline or online. So you should have that color in all your logos. It should be in your newsletters. It should be on your website. It should be in your social media. And it should be on any flyers that you have for gigs or whatever. And then the final thing is pick a font and stay with it. Your font is an equally important part of your image. So just find a font that you like and stay with it. Again, just like your color, stay with it in all of your branding. So we can talk more and more about this. And actually, I go into this in my Musical Prosperity Breakthrough Program. There's a whole module on that. If you want to check that out, just go to my website and look at the tab that says Programs, and you can see. We can go on for hours for this. This is just something really short to discover your brand. The next thing I want to talk about is Avid. Avid had another bad week. They lost four key people with over 55 years of Avid experience, including their key design exec. This is pretty bad. Actually, all four went over to Gobbler. So that's kind of interesting. Not in a good way. I can tell you that a lot of studios and users, Pro Tools users, are really scared because they're not sure what's going to happen. They're not sure if Avid is going to stay alive because they're hurting. A few months ago, they were delisted from NASDAQ. So basically, there's a lot of things that are going on in the music industry because of this. And now you find people that are hardcore Pro Tools users are kind of looking around just in case. Now they're looking at other DAWs to see if there might be something that they could jump to if something happens. Now, the reason why this is kind of important is I can remember, in the late 90s when this happened, the Sony 3324s and 3348s digital tape recorders were in every major studio. And this was a major expense that every studio had because that was the only way that you could record digitally. So everybody's paying like $250,000 for these Sony 3324s, 48s, 24 and 48 channel tape recorders. And within about 6 months, they're all obsolete. When Pro Tools came out with a new version that all of a sudden made it possible for studios to record virtually and do it in a manner that was really professional. So it didn't take long for that big hunk of Sony hardware to die out. And I remember that, and I remember how quickly things can change in the pro audio business and the recording business. So you look at Pro Tools and you think, you know, right now they're king of the hill. And if you want to be a pro, you have to know Pro Tools. But that could change in a flash. So there's no chance of that happening tomorrow, but you never know 6 months or a year down the line what might happen. So If you're a hardcore Pro Tools user, you should keep one eye on the other platforms. There's plenty of really good platforms, and now there's lots of good hardware that you can buy, so you're not tied into only what's given to you by Avid. Keep an eye out, because you don't know what's going to be coming up with this. This could change in a flash. I hope it doesn't, because there's a lot of people that are really invested in Pro Tools, not only monetarily, but from a knowledge standpoint, a lot of industrial knowledge. And right now, it's really easy to exchange files within the industry because of that. So I do hope it continues. But if not, be prepared. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Dusty Wakeman. He's the president of Mojave Audio, but he's also a bass player with loads of credits on country records with country stars like Dwight Yoakam, Lucinda Williams, Jim Lauderdale, Buck Owens, and many others. And he's also a fairly successful producer, Los Lobos, Lucinda Williams, and a lot of others. He's also the former owner of the Los Angeles studio Mad Dog, Mad Dog Studios. So here's Dusty. So I'm here with Dusty Wakeman, who's, among other things, a great bass player, a producer, an engineer, president of Mojave Audio, and probably a whole bunch of other stuff that I don't know about.
Happily former studio owner.
Oh, of course. Big thing. How can I forget that? Right. Well, actually, you know, I wanted to talk to you because I bet there's a lot of people in the pro audio world that don't know your background as a player, which is quite significant. And
I'm still playing it, man. I'm still thumping it.
I know you're still doing it. You know, what's interesting is there's so many people in the pro audio industry that we know as salespeople or executives or whatever, and then we find out their background, and you go, wow, I didn't realize. And I bet I know all about your background, but there's a lot of other people that don't.
Well, I'm always happy to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, let's do that then. So you have a whole lot of bass playing credits for people like Dwight Yoakam and Lucinda Williams and Jim Lauderdale, and I see Buck Owens. How did that come about?
So Dwight's first number one hit was called Streets of Bakersfield, and that was a duet between Buck and Dwight, and that's how I got to meet Buck. We did it at Capitol, and Buck came in to sing. And right about that time, he was getting so much attention, thanks to Dwight, Marty Stewart, and people like that, that he decided to make another record. So he liked my engineering skills, and he liked my bass playing. So they had some stuff cut already, and we went in and cut some more tracks. And I got to play bass, and I got to mix it, and it was great. And I became an honorary Buckaroo because he built the Crystal Palace. And when Doyle, the regular bass player, once he was sick and once he was on vacation, they would call me to come up and sub. So I actually got to be a Buckaroo, which is, you know, probably the thing my mother was most impressed with that I ever did.
Oh, man, I'm impressed. That's a very cool thing. Jeez. I mean, he's a legend. Not that these other people aren't great, because they are, but, you know, Buck is a legend. Jeez.
Playing with Buck was funny because it's at his club, and his band is basically just a generic country cover band. I mean, they're good, but, you know, they're just playing covers. And I would get up there, and they have a girl singer that sings when Buck's not up there. And they would ask me, do you know this song by the Dixie Chicks? And I'd be like, no. Do you know this song by, you know, whoever? I wouldn't know any of them. But then Buck would walk out, and I would know all that stuff, you know. Yeah. And then he would leave, and it was just back to the country cover band. And I'd just stand next to the keyboard player, and he'd call out the changes to me. But it was a gas being able to do that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You're from Texas, and you wound up in California where you are now. How did that happen? And I assume that you were playing in bands back in Texas. And did you just follow the dream like the rest of us to California?
Absolutely. Came to be a rock star. I was in a band with the keyboard player and the drummer from the Moving Sidewalks, which was Billy Gibbons' band before ZZ Top.
Yeah.
And the keyboard player got drafted, went to Vietnam. The drummer got replaced by Frank Beard because Frank and Dusty were like a package. So in order to get Dusty, he had to take Frank. So they had this band. Tom Moore was the keyboard player. He great B3 player, great singer. Came back from Vietnam, and they started this band called Buzzbone. And I was playing in another band out in the halls in South Texas, and their guitar player was also a really good engineer. So he would come out and train our sound guys because we'd kind of burn through them. And they needed a bass player, so they called me up, and I auditioned and moved back to Houston and spent 2 years playing with that band. That band brought me to L.A. for my first couple of trips. First time, my first impression of L.A. was Indigo Ranch out in Malibu.
Oh, man.
If you ever went there, yeah. You know, arrived in the middle of the night, woke up the next day, and, you know, it was like Maui or something. It was beautiful. So it's like, I love L.A. This is great. And then we came back and showcased at the Starwood and, you know, stayed in Hollywood. And it's like, I got to go to L.A. So the band was going to move out, and then it kind of fell apart. But I'd already, like, given up my job and my house, and, you know, I just said, screw it, I'm going anyway. And that was 1977.
Where did you get your engineering chops from?
I was always the guy in the band that, you know, set up the PA. And me and my friends, we were all really into Zappa. So we would stay up all night making tape loops and learning to edit tape and stuff like that. Just little two tracks. And then like those first, there was some machine called a Crown, and it had something called a Cross X head.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really four track, but you could change where the head was recording on the tapes. You could actually do overdubs. And we would play around with that. And the band I was in before Buzzbone was called The Barons. And these were older guys that played in the halls of South Texas and had a, you know, $1 million a year business going. They had a studio and an English label and a Spanish label. And basically it was like, oh, you want to engineer? Here's the keys. Your first session will be here tomorrow. You know, and wow. It was just, that's how I started doing it. And it was great because we worked every weekend, but the rest of the week I was just in the studio. So that's kind of where I really learned to engineer. And then when I moved to L.A., I had gotten a job at West L.A. Music in 1977. And the home recording thing just started. The TAC 3340s and the Tascam stuff, the 40-4s and 80-8s. And nobody else in the store knew anything about that stuff except for me. So, you know, rock stars were buying this stuff for their homes. Not that they ever used it, but they were buying the gear. And they had to talk to me because I was the only one that knew anything about it. So it was a really good time to be there.
And how did Mad Dog Studios start then? It started in Venice originally, right?
Yeah. After 3 years, you know, I was kind of at a crossroads where either I got back to something more creative and got up, because being on the floor, you know, working on commission is a grind. It's a great education, but I was just burnt out on it. So it was either take the corporate route and go get a rep job for Fender or somebody like that, which is what most of my friends did, or, you know, get back to something creative. I had a really good client named Mark Avnet. And he was a client of mine, really smart guy from back east. And he just said, hey, man, I'm going to start a studio. You want to do it with me? And I kind of cavalierly said, oh, okay. And we rented this space. We opened January of 1980. And the rest is showbiz history.
Now, the way I remember it, there were kind of like two bastions of country music in L.A. There was your studio did a lot of country music or country oriented music. And then there was Brian Hearn's place in Actron.
Right. And Brian pretty much preceded us, you know, and he was Emmy Lou Harris's husband, and they produced a lot of records there.
Yeah.
What happened with me, I was doing mainly punk records. Well, first off, my band, which was King Cotton, we got a deal with Island Records. And had kind of a minor K-rock hit in 1981, I think. Kind of a pre-rap, dirty song called Stick to the Grind that did really well, got us a deal with Island. Of course, we made an album that Chad Blake engineered and mixed.
Yeah.
And which never came out, like so many great records. And we got dropped. And then I was just, you know, working as a staff engineer. We made a deal with Enigma Records that 5 days a week, we just worked for Enigma. We were like their studio. So I was working with Striper and TSOL and, you know, all the Enigma stuff. And the guy, Ron Gowdy, who was the A&R guy, just said, hey, you want to do a country record? And I'm like, sure. You know, I'd just come off a TSOL album that was like, you know, a 36-hour grind. And doing some country sounded pretty good to me. So we set that up. It was called Town South of Bakersfield. And Pete Anderson produced it. And that's when I met Pete, which was really the big break in my life, was hooking up with Pete. He walked in the door the first day and it's like, hey, I'm Pete, ready? And we just started working. And, you know, we worked nonstop together for like 15 years.
Yeah.
He's still like my big brother. He's one of my best friends. That's how I got into, you know, that scene was happening. Dwight was starting to happen in L.A. Rosie Flores, you know, kind of the cowpunk scene was happening, the Screaming Sirens. And, you know, then plus there was the Valley country scene that was kind of always there, North Hollywood and, yeah. you know, the real thing. So I just fell in with all those people and it was a blast. And all of a sudden I was just doing all this country. So Dwight's success pretty much opened all those doors.
So you didn't do any in Texas then?
I did do some when I was playing in the hall. Well, I grew up hating country. I was like Deep Purple and Beatles, Stones, Deep Purple, you know, that kind of stuff. But it gets in your blood whether you want it to or not, you know, because you're just surrounded by it. So when I was playing with the Barons, playing out in the big dance halls, we played country. But we played it as loud as we played the rock stuff. And I realized, hey, there's no difference here. You know, it's just music. It's great music. So that's when I really started to love country, was just by playing it. So I had that background to draw upon.
One of the things I want to talk about is your three-string bass. Because...
Well, do you want the truth or the lie? Which one do you want first?
I want both, actually.
Okay, well, the lie is that we told for many years, Skip Edwards actually made this up, the great keyboard player, but that I found it, you know, in the newspaper, and it just said Fender three-string bass, and I went over to a garage sale and found it, and they weren't quite sure where it came from. You know, the dad who'd passed away had it, but that we found out that Leo and Freddie Tavares had, you know, gone out drinking margaritas, and Leo said, I want to make a five-string bass. This is early 60s, and they got too many margaritas. Freddie went back and made a three-string bass. Couldn't remember the number, so he just string. And the next day, Leo came in and said, no, it's supposed to be five string. So it was just a one-of-a-kind bass. That's the story. The reality is Rick Turner made it for me. And it was when I was playing in Pete Anderson's band, and everybody was starting to play five- and six-string basses, which I'm, you know, violently against, yeah. at least for me playing.
Yeah.
I like it when somebody else is good at it, but, you know, not for me.
Yeah.
And Rick got into it, and it was just, you know, it's like, just throw something together, you know, some parts. So he would call me up, and it's like, look, I found this really great body, but it's only going to be 200 more. Then he would call up, I found this really great neck. It's only going to, so the thing ended up costing a fortune, but it's a beautiful instrument. And it's always had Labella heavy gauge flat wounds on it. And the, you know, the bridge cover and the pickup cover and foam under the bridge. And it's a thud monster.
Oh, the real deal.
And it's been on a lot of records.
Well, it's very cool. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about country bass players is you guys always stay with the root. You play really simple and you know, it's the root five, and it always feels so good and so big and so fat. And, you know, guys, as you well know, they have five and six string basses, man, they tend to fly all over the place, and you know, you kind of lose the bottom end.
Yeah, I think if you want to play guitar, just go buy a Strat, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I like to go and take cruises, and I've realized the last two cruises I was on, there's no guitar players on,
wow.
on any of the bands. And instead, what you'd have are bass players that would have six string, and even the last guy had a seven string bass.
Wow.
And then it dawned on me, well, they don't want guitar players because they're loud.
Right.
You know? Right. And, you know, you can have a bass player go off and do whatever, and it kind of fits and, you know, never gets in anybody's way. But in that case, it worked perfectly. And again, with the player that kind of knows what they're doing and can play with it, it's, you know, pretty cool. But generally speaking, hey, three strings, probably enough, huh?
It's pretty cool. And it makes you play a certain way because you keep, you know, you kind of end up staying in first position a lot,
yeah,
and just defaulting to the lowest note. So whereas you might keep going up in a run, you'll have to jump back down in kind of an odd place.
Yeah.
And it ends up really cool that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was, you know, I don't play it that much anymore, you know, once in a while for recording. Because, you know, I do so much playing these days with people that we don't rehearse. We just get together. That it's easier to play the three string if it's something you've rehearsed and kind of figured out how you're going to get from here to there, you know?
Got it.
But if I have to think on my feet, it's nice to have that G string handy.
What's your preference for gear?
I'm a Fender guy. Yeah. I just think when they invented it, they got it right the first time.
P bass?
So I've got a P, I've got a 61P, and then I've got a reissue of a 62 jazz bass that's my main instrument that I bought in 88, I think, or 89, when they first started making them in the U.S. again. And I bought it off the shelf. I was going on my first tour, and I didn't want to take my real 61. You know, I didn't know how that was going to be because I'd never been to Europe before.
Yeah.
So I bought this other bass to take, and it ended up being a great instrument, and that's my main bass. I've got a Gibson EB3, I've got my Hagstrom from high school.
Oh, man.
And I just sold a Fender Bass 6 that I had just because I'm kind of getting rid of stuff that I never use.
Yeah.
If it's just been sitting in the case for years, I'm liquidating and kind of sparing it down.
Yeah.
Paring it down. But mainly Fenders.
And how about amps? What do you use?
Amps, usually use Ampeg. I've got a B15 that doesn't move. It's at home. And then I've got an Ampeg Rocket bass amp that's a little solid state that I bought 20 years ago for $300 as a rehearsal amp. And I've played played the Roxy with that. I mean, that's the main amp I use. But my favorite bass amp is a Blackface Dual Showman through an ice cabinet. Oh, I just love them.
Wow.
That's a great bass amp. And, of course, SVTs, but, couldn't lift it. So
yeah,
it's kind of, unless you have roadies, that's kind of out of the question. I see that they're making the V4s again.
Yes, as a matter of fact.
I'm curious to play through one of those.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of a half of an SVT.
Those are always pretty cool. The cabinets were too. The inverted horn that they used, which is always kind of cool. No high end, but the low end was.
I'm not a high end guy. I see a tweeter on a speaker bass cabinet, and I'm just, first thing I do is reach around and turn it off.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like there's nothing up there that interests me for my playing.
You were the musical director and the person behind the Graham Parsons tribute a few years ago, I remember, that was so cool. And you had a tremendous number of celebrities on that as well. How did that come
about? That was the biggest thrill of my life, those two shows. We had Keith Richards and Norah Jones, Steve Earle, Dwight, Lucinda. The list goes on and on. It was great. I'm friends. Graham's been a big part of my life because back in high school when the Byrds came out with Sweetheart of the Rodeo, that kind of made it okay to like, we called it hippie country. Hmm. It kind of made it okay because we were surrounded by redneck country and hated it. But that style was cool. Chris Hillman was always a hero of mine. Still is. And so moving out here and being part of the LA country scene where all that stuff happened with the Byrds and Poco and Flying Burrito Brothers, it all happened in LA. I got to be friends with Polly Parsons, Graham's daughter, and a lady named Shyla Morrow. And they're the ones that really put it together. And fortunately, I was able to convince them to let me, instead of hiring Don West, to let me be musical director, put the band together. And it was amazing. And I got to mix the DVD. It was the only thing I've ever mixed in surround. Well, you came over and calibrated the system for me.
That's right, yeah.
Like, I should probably call Bobby because I don't know what I'm doing. But it was a blast. It's 10 years ago, and now we're putting on a show in November. There's going to be a screening of the highlights of the DVD at the Grammy Museum, I think on the 6th. And there'll be a show somewhere either on the 5th or the 7th. The 5th is Graham's birthday. So it'll be much smaller than what we did before. It'll be a club gig and more of a party scene than a concert. But we're going to honor it. It's been 10 years. And we also are all lobbying to try to get Graham in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, sure.
And so it's that season again. So it's all kind of tying together.
Yeah.
You'll have to come to the Grammy Museum and see this.
I'd love to. Yeah, great. That sounds great. Well, I remember seeing the DVD when it was being mastered and, hanging in on that whole thing, and it was dynamite.
It was such a thrill. That was the peak of my playing career, and after that, it's like whatever happens from now, the me being on stage with Keith Richards, you know, is like so far beyond my wildest dreams from a, you know, suburban white trash kid from Houston that it's all good from here on out.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And I got the picture. I got the picture between the last song and the encore. I got the picture of me and Keith together. That's, you know, my prized possession. So it's all good.
I had a similar experience when I was a kid. I grew up in Minersville, Pennsylvania, which had 5,000 people in it, rural, very rural Pennsylvania, probably as far away from the music business as you can get. And I can remember being in my bedroom listening to a Rolling Stones concert. And I could hear, I remember Mick Taylor ripping off a solo and thinking, boy, I would do anything to play with someone like that. And I come to L.A. and I produced a bunch of blues albums, and Mick came in and he actually played on some. And the next thing I know, I was his musical director.
Oh, cool.
So,
wow.
And what was cool was we had one SIR rehearsal before we went out on the road. And we finished it because it was blues and, you know, you don't have to rehearse it all that much. And we had some time at the end, and he turned to me and he says, I feel like playing a Stones song. Let's play Jumpin' Jack Flash and you play the lead.
Oh, my God.
So he detunes and he plays, you know, in that open G tuning, the Stones right. tuning. And he hit that first chord and I flash back to when I was a kid and it seemed so far away. And, you know, I was like, hey, anything else from here is gravy, you know.
Yeah, right. Just beyond your wildest dreams. You never think that'll happen.
Yeah. And it can, and that's the whole, that's the cool thing, and that's
you
why.
You just got to keep showing up, you know?
That's what I like to tell people, that, you know, what may be a dream today may be reality tomorrow, so just, right. as you say, keep showing up, that's really cool. You have a lot of production credits, I noticed, that, so how did you reconcile being an engineer and a player and a producer all at the same time? Because that's pretty hard. It's hard to do all those things. Some people can't. I'm one of them. I can't do all three at the same time. How did you?
Well, usually if I did all three, it's because it was a small budget and it was budgetary constraints. So I would end up doing all three. And I love to play. And for me, playing and producing work really well together. Because like cutting a basic track, if I played on it, you know when the tape stops, whether you got it or not, you just instinctively know that was great. You know, you don't have to go back and analyze stuff a lot. I mean, I just do roots music, Americana, and, you know, so for the kind of music I do, you can do it like that. You know, it's I'm not doing big 72 track pop things or anything. It's a different world. But that goes really well together. The engineering and producing is harder. And the more I got into engineering, the more I like to have an engineer up there. I mean, the more I got into production, the more I like to have an engineer sitting in the hot seat, you know, watching levels and doing all that, because it's hard. That's a hard transition for me to go back and forth.
Yeah,
but
me too.
I love mixing stuff that I produced because all the pieces, you know, it's like, oh, let's put all the pieces together.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. I don't know. I just, you know, I enjoy all three. They're different parts of my brain and I enjoy doing it. I remember reading about Jim Messina when I was a kid and he was in the Buffalo Springfield, but he started as their engineer. That's how he met him.
Oh, I didn't know.
He was kind of like the guy for the last album that they did. And it's like, well, this guy, you know, he's an engineer and he plays guitar. He actually played bass with the last version of the Buffalo Springfield. And it's like, you know, if he can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
So I just kept doing it, you know.
Do you have a particular musical philosophy?
If it feels good, it is good. You know, I'm just a total feel guy. It's all because I love every kind of music. You know, if it's got a groove, then I like it. And if it doesn't groove, then it doesn't matter what genre it is. Yeah. You know, but I have very eclectic taste. As far as what I listen to for pleasure, I love putting my iPod on random and just letting it go crazy, you know?
Yeah. I always believe that no matter what, every type of music, especially hits, no matter what a hit is, there's always some magic that's captured. So,
right.
At the very least, you have to appreciate it for that ability to capture the magic, even if you don't like the artist or the music or the song or whatever. You know, just as creators, as we are creators of music, you have to look at it and say, wow, they managed to capture something that a lot of people like, and that's not easy.
Right. Oh, I totally agree. Yeah, you got to respect it, even if it's not your thing.
Yeah, definitely. I was looking at your credits before we did this, and I noticed that you played bass on a SpongeBob.
Yeah, that yeah. was a thrill. Well, I don't know if you know Andy Paley or not, but Paley's been around town for a long time. And he's just a he's a funny guy, but he's really brilliant. He produced a Brian Wilson album, and he's got a lot of Brian Wilson orchestration in his soul. You know, he'll drag a set of vibes and a real timpani and things like that into the studio. So we've gotten to be friends. Well, I engineered an album for him. He was A&R guy for it was Seymour Stein's label. I forget.
Sire.
Yeah. Right. And they had signed Dale Watson, who was an L.A. country guy, lives in Austin now, like a real Merle Haggard kind of guy. So I got the gig. I didn't even meet Andy until the day we started. It was another one of those. I think we talked on the phone once, but he figured it was my studio and I knew all these people, so I'd be okay. And we just really bonded. He was a great guy, really creative and kind of an old school, even though he's so super musical, when he produces, it's more like that old school big picture kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like he wouldn't really get into like chords and notes and stuff like that. It was more like, you know, that's the magic performance right there, or this one, I'm not feeling it. So we really bonded. And, you know, at Mad Dog, I was always way too generous and I just kind of gave him carte blanche to do stuff there because he would do stuff. And eventually I got paid for everything he did. You know, he would do stuff and not know where it was going to go. But him and Tom Kenny are partners. It's like, we're going to do a SpongeBob record. And basically I just said, if I don't get to play bass on a track, I will kill you. And that's how it happened. But it was me and James Burton and Andy on drums. And, you know, it's great.
Wow. Well, just playing with James Burton, you know, yeah, that's so cool as well.
Well, also James was part of the Big Graham shows.
Right, right.
Which was another thrill.
Again, another legend. Definitely. Yep. Definitely.
Yeah, and just a great guy, still rocking hard. You know, you look at his schedule, he's just all over the place playing and got a lot going on back in Shreveport where he lives.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize he's got a
foundation there. He's got a studio that's mainly educational.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's doing all sorts of stuff.
I was just in Memphis last week, which is a great music town. And one of the things I saw was Stax has an academy for underprivileged children, and Steve Cropper is teaching guitar there.
Oh, cool.
And I thought, man, that is so cool. You know, I'd like to be a fly in the wall for that myself.
You bet. I read your column this morning about Memphis, and I've been to Memphis once, but I was there and John Fry from Arden gave us the Stax tour, which is really great when you get it from him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if you met Jeff Powell or not. He used to be a staff engineer at Arden, and now he's independent, but he works there all the time. He's a dear friend, and his wife, Susan Marshall, is an amazing, amazing, kind of a white Aretha Franklin singer. And if you come to Potluck, they'll be there. So hopefully you'll come to Potluck this year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Mojave Audio, you're the president of Mojave. How did you make the transition from being a studio owner to being the president of a pro audio microphone manufacturer?
Well, you know, first off, I had worked at West LA Music for 3 years. So I kind of had some sales, you know, I knew people in that part of the industry. And, you know, I produced, played, engineered nonstop for 25 years. And my wife and I, she worked in the film business. She was a set decorator. So we were just like always gone, you know, and we waited to start a family for a long time. And my mom passed away and my son was born within like 3 weeks of each other in 1999. And it was kind of one of those like, okay, time to grow up a little bit. And I realized that I was a small business owner. I never really thought about that before. I just figured I'm going to produce a couple of multi-platinum albums. Boom, done. That's my business plan.
Yeah.
Didn't quite work out. You know, got close sometimes, but never really worked out that way. So I finally realized, and with Mad Dog, it was like I was ready to either take it to the next step, you know, which is when we got up to 3 rooms in Burbank, and I got the vintage Neve from Sylvia, and just really did my best to make it the best studio I could make it. I went back to Glendale Community College and took 2 semesters of accounting and a business law class and a computer class, which was all Office and Excel and all that stuff. And it really changed my life. it really, you know, I was like, how do people not know this stuff and function, you know?
Yeah.
And that gave me some skills and, you know, plus running a studio, which is a small business, you get used to doing, you know, tax forms and payroll and all that crap that you have to do to run a business, that all of those skills I'm using now in Mojave. So I just kind of have a weird, messed up, eclectic skill set, you know, from my life that's, you know, I'm living on now. The way I got attached to Mojave was I did an album, I think it was in 1999 as well, for a producer named Craig Street. And it was a Michelle and Deggio cello album. Oh, and he's kind of like a more of a jazz guy from New York. Great guy. And I'd been working with Pete for so long. We kind of had our way of doing things. And Craig came in with a bunch of coals and a couple of racks full of esoteric stuff that I didn't know.
Coal microphones, you mean?
Coal's microphones, yeah, right. And every time I'd ask him, you know, what do you want to use on this? He goes, well, try the coals on it. And it just sounded great on everything. Abe Laboriel Jr. was the drummer. Huh. So we had like a coals on the kick drum, like 3 feet away, my 47 overhead. And then once in a while, a snare mic. And that was it. And it just sounded fabulous. You know, we'd use the coals on the guitar amps and on the piano. And I just fell in love with them because I hadn't really used ribbons that much except for, okay, go to Capitol, book a horn date, get the RCAs out, you know. But as far as using it for other stuff, I really wasn't that hip to them. And did that album. It's like, I got to get some ribbons and started investigating. Well, like the next week, I saw the first review for Royer Ribbons in probably Mix Magazine, you know, when they came out with the 121. And I noticed they were in Burbank, and I just called them up and said, hi, neighbor. You know, I'm down the street. I'd like to get to know you guys. And that's how I met John Jennings.
Yeah.
And we became friends. You know, I was doing like some big band recording at Mad Dog, and I'd call up and go, John, can I borrow like, you know, 8 121s and 8 122s and 3 SF24s. And he'd be like, sure, I'll get it together for you. You know, and we got to be really close. They did a bunch of the Royer demo CD, the first one at Mad Dog. And we just got to be good friends. Well, he walked in, Eddie Kramer was recording at Mad Dog, and he had my two prize 67s up as room mics. And John walked in with the prototype for the MA200. And Eddie's like, well, let's put it up. And we put it up with the 67s. And you really couldn't tell which one wasn't a 67.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been any pair, because my two didn't sound exactly alike anyway. They're 50 years old, but they both sounded great. And I was really impressed. And it's like, well, how much are you going to sell this for? He goes, it's going to be about $1,000. And the wheel started turning. And I was like, So I talked to him later and said, look, you know, I'm really burnt out on doing this. I'm kind of looking for a change. If you guys need any help. You know, he goes, well, we're looking for somebody to run the company. And, you know, that was like a 3-hour conversation. And 10 months later, I started over here. And, you know, that's been almost 9 years now.
It's that long.
Yeah. And it's just been a blast. I mean, it was falling in love with the mic that got me into it. And I'm still dealing with so many people that were my clients before, you know, that all have their own rooms now, you know, Dave Bianco and Joe Barisi and Sylvia Massey and people like that, that were all kind of Mad Dog regulars. You know, they've all got their own rooms now, and I'm still dealing with them, but it's just, I'm wearing a different hat.
Yeah.
So it's really been a blessing. It's been right place at the right time, just saying yes to things, whether you're sure you can do it or not, you know, just say yes and then figure out how to do it. And it's been great.
I'm a big Mojave fan myself, and of course, I've used them on various things. You've loaned some to me, and they've been great. I got to say, it's everything that everyone says. And unfortunately, I wish more people knew about Mojave and understand, right, you know, the lineage with David Royer, because it's very impressive. He's an impressive guy, impressive engineer for sure.
Well, I'm preaching that gospel as much as I can, you know, all the time, and telling the story. Because the short version, David Royer, before he brought ribbon mics back from the dead, before there was a Royer Labs, was hand-making mics in his garage in Fullerton under the Mojave name. And there's still some of those floating around. A lot of them, look, we call them pipe bombs. You know, they're getting old now, but they still sound great. People love them. And basically, those mics are the same as what we're making now. Same basic design, same philosophy, the same tube, You know, David had gotten started playing around when the cheap Chinese mics appeared. You know, he was playing around with them. Okay, how can I take this and make it better? So he discovered that the capsules were actually really good. They're, you know, very consistent. They're mass produced, and the capsules just aren't a problem. It was the cheap electronics that made them sound so crappy. Oh. So he published in 2001 an article on Tapop, how to take a $100 Marshall microphone and put a Jensen transformer and a tube in it and change out some other key components and have a really great sounding mic. So there was a lot of response to that. So the guys over here at Royer, this was before my time, decided to make a kit. And for $350, you could buy a kit, and it had instructions and everything you need, an ammo case for the power supply. And, you know, it was, but the last thing you want to do is be in the kit business on any sort of scale, because you spend all your time on the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've reversed pins 1 and pin 7, and it's not working. And you get David on the phone, that's an hour anyway. So, because he's got a lot to say, he's got a lot of information. So that's when they said, well, we should just manufacture these so that we have quality control over them. And that's what led to the modern version of Mojave Audio. That's where I came in. But, you know, working with David every day, as somebody that was a career engineer for 25 years, you know, I'm amazed how little I really knew about microphones. And I'm still learning every day from David. He's just a walking encyclopedia of microphones.
Yeah, I know every time I come over there, it's the same thing. I get to talking to him, and it's like I walk out of there, my head swimming, thinking, well, I didn't know that or that or that. And wow, it's amazing how much I learned in just an hour.
Yeah, I keep thinking we're going to hit the, you know, get to the end of the book, but there's no sign of that yet.
Yeah.
But working with David is just great. I mean, he's truly unique, you know, brilliant guy. And there's not that many of those around. Our business, I think, has a lot of them, you know. But David's certainly one of them, and it's a pleasure to work with him.
Well, this has been great, Dusty. Thanks for your time and for your history lesson.
Absolutely.
Lessons, I should say. It's very cool. You know, it's funny because one of the things I always find when I interview someone is you never really know someone until you interview them. I've had friends I've known for 25 years, and there are things I always find out that are new to me. And the same thing today, where I learned a whole bunch of new things about you, too.
Very great. Cool. Well, listen, I'm really glad you're doing this podcast, and hope you keep it up. It's a great thing.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks very much, Dusty.
You bet. My pleasure.
If you want to find out more about Dusty, go to mojaveaudio.com/aboutus, and there's a little blurb on him. You can also go to Wikipedia. There's a nice Wikipedia entry on Dusty as well. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Also, if you're a subscriber on iTunes, it would really help if you leave a comment. Let me know what you think, and let me know how we can improve this podcast as well. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's really responsible for the podcast. He's the guy that, in so many ways, makes this podcast go. He not only edits it and puts it together, but he's the impetus behind it happening in the first place. If it wasn't for Steve, I wouldn't be doing this. So thank you, Steve. You can find out more about him at edmmr.com. He's the host of the EDM Producer podcast as well. So that's EDMMR for Steve. To listen to other podcasts of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com. At bobbyosinski.com, there are links to my blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and also for alerts to this podcast as well. This is Bobby Osinski, and I will see you next time.